You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. We recorded this exchange on March 5th and unfortunately experienced some audio difficulties during the recording. My guest is Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley. He and Senator Ron Wyden joined an Oregon delegation and more than 100 other members of Congress in signing a letter this week to the White House demanding that the Trump administration stop and reverse the mass firing of federal employees and restore funds cut from critical programs that serve Oregon's rural communities and tribes. Welcome to the exchange, Senator Merkley.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Well, I know this letter is a big deal, but we have to start with the elephant in the room. Donald Trump addressed a joint session of Congress last night, and Senator Merkley, you attended that event and hosted a virtual town hall immediately after. What did you hear Trump say, and what did you say to your constituents?
Well, I heard last night Trump basically brag about his executive orders in the style of a carnival barker. Come up to my booth, hear the wonderful things that can be achieved here. You throw the darts, you puncture the balloons, you'll get a big prize. That was kind of the tone. And what really struck me is he didn't want to talk at all about his plan to do $2 trillion in cuts to basic programs for families to thrive in health care, housing, and education. His plan to use that $2 trillion to fund more tax giveaways to the mega millionaires and billionaires. And his plan to add additional $2.5 trillion on top of currently anticipated deficits running up our national debt. Instead, he put up a smokescreen. And just in a bizarre Orwellian way, bragging about balancing the budget when he's doing the opposite, he's running up a lot more red ink than current law would produce.
And so in your virtual town hall after the speech, what did you say to your constituents?
So I laid out exactly that it's so important for us not to be distracted by conversations about Panama or Greenland or the latest executive order and understand that the core program here as laid out in Project 2025 and being implemented by the architect of Project 2025, Russell Vogt, is to do massive cuts to basic programs to enrich the richest among us. We can't take our eyes off that, and we have to keep bringing it up. And meanwhile, his mass firings are absolutely eviscerating core services. They're not about waste. They are indiscriminate. The highly trained, incredibly professional folks that he wants to replace with Elon Musk and his minions. I want professionals in charge delivering services, and I hate to see those professionals being fired to either have no one deliver services or to have loyalists hired who have no intention or qualifications to deliver those services.
Well, Senator, I saw something last night that was extremely disturbing. Representative Al Green was escorted out of the room for his protests on the floor of the House during Trump's speech. And in your virtual town hall last night, you made three recommendations. One of those was for us, your constituents, to protest. Now, I saw some of the representatives in Congress leave in protest, but only one stood up and made his protest clear to the entire congregation and to Trump directly. Yet, there was a chorus of cheers that erupted from the Republicans when Representative Green was removed. So if our representatives who protest on the floor of Congress in a joint session directly to the president have no power of persuasion, what power do the rest of us have standing in the street?
Well, I think there was a lot of power in Al Green's protest. He disrupted the proceedings for about 5 minutes and basically said to America, what's happening is not okay. There was no mandate for this process of cutting services and enriching tax cuts for the richest Americans. I'm glad he did it. I also think it's important for us to be able to bear witness. But one of the things that I did is I brought with me a Ukrainian flag. When we start talking about foreign policy, Ukraine and Russia, I held it high over my head. I wanted to send a message that it's absolutely unacceptable to be spouting Russian propaganda from the Oval Office. It is absolutely unacceptable to be supporting a dictator over a democracy. People who share our values, who share our values in freedom of speech and religion and assembly, and have been determined to maintain the ability for people through democratic representation to govern themselves as opposed to being governed by a dictator. So there was a lot going on last night, but speaking to the power of the people, we have three powers here. One, for those of us who are elected, to use every tool at our disposal. And that means, for example, when Russell Vogt was being nominated to be head of OMB, I forced maximum press exposure to who he was, his background, his deliberate strategy of violating the law and dishonoring the Constitution. And then we did 30 hours of debate on the floor, going through the night to say to the American people, this matters. This man is unfit for office, and here's why. And then the courts have to do their job to stand up for the Constitution. And admittedly, we're very worried about that, but a lot of the lower courts certainly are standing up and saying when the law says you can't fire inspector generals, then you have to follow the law. You didn't give 30 days notice, you didn't give cause, you can't fire them. When the law says that you cannot impound funds, and the Constitution, the Supreme Court has said the president can't impound funds, then you've got to follow the Supreme Court's constitutional vision, the separation of powers. But President Trump is violating that. Hopefully, when these issues get to the Supreme Court, they will proceed to defend the vision of our Constitution. We are worried about that because they've already found some lines written in the Constitution that the rest of us can't find. One's about the president being immune for prosecution for crimes he commits if those crimes were committed by saying it was a government act. That is absolutely the opposite of what our founders intended. When they wrote the Constitution, they wanted a president, not a king. They were very, very worried about a president trying to assemble powers and take control and violate the vision of the Constitution. Certainly was so important for George Washington to pass on peacefully power to the next president. And we've had that sustained for 250 years, but now we have a president who wants authoritarian powers and we're going to depend on the courts. But the third power is the power of the people. And I was so excited to see people in the streets of Astoria when I drove through a couple weeks ago, you know, three blocks, three to five deep, protesting the administration. We're going to see protests all over this country. They need to happen, particularly in red congressional districts, in red states, to say we value our republic. It's unacceptable that President Trump is destroying it.
My guest is Senator Jeff Merkley. He's part of an Oregon delegation of elected leaders and more than 100 members of Congress who signed a letter this week to the White House demanding that the Trump administration stop and reverse the mass firing of federal employees and restore funds cut from programs serving Oregon's rural communities and tribes. Now, Senator, I hear you say these three points. You protested as our elected representative, and yet the people Trump wanted still got appointed. The court ruled Trump ignored those rules. We protest, Trump still ignores the protest. What do you hope the letter that you signed and all these other representatives signed will achieve?
Well, I'll tell you, last night I had a guest with me, Isabella Isakson, who was fired from the Forest Service a few days short of her completing her probationary year. During that year, from May to October, because the fires were so bad last year in Oregon, she says she was only off 2 days from May to October. Think of the dedication to only take 2 days off in a period of May through October. And she's somebody who served her country through the Army. She actually represented our country as an Olympian in the 2016, and she was very proud to represent the United States. She's somebody who's been a focused, dedicated, I'm going to do everything I can to deliver the best for the team I'm working for. And this team was the Forest Service. And her story spoke to the story of thousands and thousands of folks summarily dismissed, trying to deliver the best services in housing and health care and education and forest management and wildfire preparations and delivery of the ability for us to enjoy and recreate in our federal forests and our federal BLM lands, things that are near and dear to our culture and to our economy. As she pointed out, the Ochoco Forest, where she was employed, has a lot of grazing permits, so it's a key part of the surrounding economy. I think it was important to have folks present last night who came from many different walks in the federal government to say, here is the damage being done with these indiscriminate firings. And that was the purpose of that letter. And think about it in terms of the BPA, Bonneville Power. I mean, we want professionals running the grid. They've got to deal with flood control. They've got to deal with salmon migration. They've got to deal with incorporating renewable energy. So it's a very complex task while they're trying to keep an exact 110 volts on the line so that all of our electrical systems function perfectly. So we want professionals in charge. We don't want lackeys, and we don't want key personnel fired that are going to endanger those services.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator. We only have about 3 minutes left, and there's another huge elephant in the room that we need to address, and that's race. Now, Trump has framed the support for his blitzkrieg of executive orders as a mandate from the American people, but the data don't lie. He's referring to white American people. The only voting demographic with a majority supporting Trump were white men at 60% and white women at 53%, and white women are the largest voting demographic. Plus, 85% of white conservative evangelicals make up most of Trump's base. But there's no non-white voting group that has a majority support for Trump, none. And the largest non-white voting demographic is black women, which opposed Trump and the Republican Party by at least 90% in 2016, again in 2020, and again in 2024. And consequently, Trump's attacks on DEI, civil rights, voting rights, the 14th Amendment, and whatever can be taught in our schools all have adverse impact on black voters and other populations of color. So this election appears, by the numbers, to have fallen along racial fault lines. So how do you assess the election outcome, and what is the solution to finding common ground across this racial divide?
So let's start with the fact that Trump did not win a majority of the votes. He won a plurality, but he did not win over 50%. He is claiming a mandate as if it was a sweeping victory across America. It certainly was not. It's to his advantage to claim a mandate. And what you see in his actions are as you described. It is a bias against minorities, and it's a bias against bluer states. And I must say, let's talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So much of our history is replete with barriers for people to be able to participate. And those barriers meant that usually qualified individuals who had so much to contribute were blocked from participating. And so DEI, diversity, I believe in diversity, meaning I want the talents of every group in America be brought to bear to address and build a better community, a better state, a better country. Equity is fairness. At fairness, we know the barriers that exist, the blatant discrimination. We absolutely should fight for equity. And so inclusion, that again refers to breaking down of barriers so people can participate according to their interests and according to their talents. Indeed, we see in his operations an enormous bias that is profoundly troubling. And I think we have to work together to recognize that if we're going to change the direction, we're going to have to use every component now, as I mentioned, both through the elected officials, through our courts, and through our protests. But then comes the next election. And the next election, we better have a majority in the House elected that restores the vision of opportunity for every American. Because that opportunity for every American is not a Trumpian value. So let's have a resounding, if you will, response to tell a very different story when we next have an opportunity to cast a ballot.
Well, between now and then, a majority of white voters elected Trump and voted for Trump in 2016, again in 2020, even though he lost, and again in 2024. So that majority of white voters they're stuck on Trump. And they're applauding him in the chamber during the joint session. So between now and the next opportunity, how do we bridge that divide and have some discourse with those who are supporting Trump and those who are adversely affected by his mandates?
Yes. So here is a very troubled vision. And that is, you look at republics around the world who have a constitutional framework who have lost that. And often it is lost when there is acquiescence from a majority of the legislative branch of government to simply defer to the executive. Suddenly you have no separation of power. Suddenly you have no checks and balances. Suddenly you have authoritarian outrages. That group that you said was applauding last night were Republicans basically saying, we don't care if Trump's violating the law. We don't care if he's violating the Constitution. We are applauding it. And that puts us really on this very, very dangerous position. Now, in terms of the dialogue you're talking about, is very challenging because in order to have a dialogue, you have to have two parties interested in sitting down and having that conversation. Well, listen, Trump is not interested in that conversation. So we will try to find ways to create it. Russell Vogt, who came in, who I tried to really shine the spotlight on how dangerous this is, he refers to himself as a Christian nationalist. But if you look carefully, it's essentially white nationalism. And what that means is he wants to see a country by and for white Americans. So it's embedded, the top layers of this administration is a determination for racial discrimination.
Unfortunately, we're out of time for today's exchange, Senator. We're going to have to talk about this again soon, my guess.
Well, thank you for raising such powerful and important issues of opportunity and the dialogue across the boundaries and the racial boundaries that seem more difficult now than any time I can remember in decades.
Absolutely.